Thank you, Brigitte. It's a great pleasure to be here, and very exciting to have so many experts in the audience. In fact, I don't think I'll say anything that will be new to each of you. The work I'll talk about is sort of an. Do you know how to adjust the focus? Or maybe it's good enough, I don't know. All right, it's focused enough. Very good. This is sort of an ongoing collaboration with Sadowski, Chetan, Walker, and Wong, who are here at KITP. It's a variation on an older theme with important work and steps by people, almost all of whom are here today. Alexey Kitaev, Greg Cooperberg, Bentley, Fradkin, Levin, and Wen. What is the subject? It's this golden theory, the Fibonacci theory. The motivation will be to try to learn something which will help us eventually build this TQFT in a physical system. The doubled Fibonacci theory, in some way, in many ways, is the very simplest sort of fully non-abelian theory. Well, the Fibonacci theory is a chiral theory, which I'll begin with, which is even simpler and also non-abelian. This talk will not sort of be looking toward the quantum Hall aspects of the conference, but instead, as Mike Levins did, toward maybe a solid-state implementation eventually in a spin system. There we're thinking probably not of breaking time reversal symmetry with the magnetic field as in quantum Hall, but looking for achiral TQFTs. This is the reason why it'll actually be the doubled Fibonacci theory that will come up in today. Before I can discuss the double, let me give you a primer on the very simple two-particle Fibonacci theory. This theory is amazingly simple. It's a particle theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. It has one non-trivial particle, which we call tau, and it has the single non-trivial fusion rule that if you fuse tau with itself, either the trivial particle can come out or tau can come out. It goes under the names golden theory, Fibonacci theory, Chern-Simons-Witten theory for the Lie group G2 at level 1, Chern-Simons-Witten theory for the Lie group SO3 at level 3. Occurs in other places as well. It's related, as we saw in Vaughan Jones's lecture, to type 2-1 factors. At the bottom of the screen here, I'll just slide it up a little bit, is the reason it's called Fibonacci, because the Fibonacci numbers come out. Imagine that you have a plane of this marvelous material that's in this, what I'm calling the Fibonacci phase, and suppose it has a sequence of non-trivial excitations or quasi-particles of the only non-trivial type, tau. Those are the red dots. Now, we're fixing in our mind their position, so we only have the internal degrees of freedom, which we expect to be finite in number, to describe. And these internal degrees of freedom are parameterized by the labels of a fusion tree. If we imagine bringing the particles together in some fixed pattern, then the fusion tree would tell us the fusion outcomes, and that would be a basis for the internal degrees of freedom. So the tree I've drawn, I'm sort of fusing from left to right. And using the fusion rule, I'm entitled to write down a variety of labels down the diagonal here. And I've just written tau 1, tau, tau, tau 1, tau. I could never put two ones in a row. That would be illegal. It would violate a fusion rule because it tau coming down would meet a 1 and fuse into a 1. That would look bizarre. So if you ask the number of strings that can be written with that combinatorial rule that a 1 cannot follow itself, but a tau can follow itself, then that the number of such strings is the Fibonacci number. Or another way of saying it is, if you fuse the left two particles, since you can output either a 1 or a tau, it recursively reduces the degrees of freedom in the case of n plus 2 particles to the sum of the degrees present in n plus 1 and n, which is the famous recursion relation for the Fibonacci numbers. So this is the Hilbert space that Vaughan was talking about in his talk that grows in this little bit surprising way, not just as powers of 2, but more or less as powers of the golden ratio. So here's the data. If you want to know everything in the world about the Fibonacci anions, go home and do your own calculations. These are the twist parameters. If you have a simple kink, it's worth a certain phase. And if you have a Y with a kink in the Y, it's worth a different phase. And from this information, you can extract the braiding relations. If you take two particles and you do a right-handed half twist, it'll be different from not having done anything, from the identity, again, by a phase. And which phase comes up depends on the collective charge of the two particles. Around the two particles, you can imagine drawing a circle and asking, what's the collective charge inside? And it could either be one or a tau, and that accounts for the two different phases. Also, there's the S matrix, which has to do, on the one hand, with quantum evaluations of links labeled by particles, and on the other hand, by the S matrix on the torus, the symmetry between meridian and longitude. And here it is very simple, 1 tau, tau minus 1 times a factor. And then there's the punctured S matrix, which is another phase. And the relations that Mike Levin had in his talk, the F matrix, or 6J symbol, which tells you when you recouple small diagrams, what the coefficients are coming in and going out. So if you want to do calculations, this is sort of the fact sheet. Now, I want to tell you what the doubled theory is. I've just described the Fibonacci theory itself. So the doubled theory is the matrices in the Fibonacci theory, or said a little bit more sophisticated language, it's the tensor product of the Fibonacci theory with itself. Matrices, I should say, from the dual of Fibonacci theory with itself, but the star doesn't mean anything in this case because the Fibonacci theory is its own dual. Or another language, you could say, well, it's the operators, the Wilson loops in the Fibonacci theory. So let's take this last statement sort of seriously and look at it on a physical level. You know, how should we think of the Wilson loops in the Fibonacci theory? So that means a state in the doubled theory should look like an operator or a Wilson loop in the ordinary Fib theory. So the Wilson loop is drawn here in purple. It's actually a branched Wilson loop, and it's sloping up. Time runs vertically in the picture, and you should imagine that the operator in question changes the state at the initial time to the final time by this kind of crazy purple particle history of pairs of tau anions being born out of the vacuum, interacting, and eventually going back into the vacuum. So you might think that we have a chiral system here for the Fibonacci theory, which may be a quantum Hall fluid at some level. And we change the state of this chiral theory by sort of screwing around with these purple anions for a while, and then we get a new state at the top. So this screwing around with anions in the middle, that's the operator that changes you from an initial state to a final state. So that's why you should think of these sort of purple networks of, or Wilson loops of tau particles as operators on a more primitive theory. They're thought of as the operators on the chiral theory. Okay. No, I'm just telling you it is. I mean, in other words, I'm trying to explain, I'm going to discuss the doubled Fibonacci theory as a theory of string nets in the Levin-Wen language. And I want to explain what the relation is to the original Fibonacci theory. See, I told you what the original Fibonacci theory is: chiral. It has a it will have a central charge. And I'm just trying to make very clear the relationship between the original theory and its double. And you should think of the original theory as the operators. The final theory, the double, is the operators on the original theory. Greg. Half of all the operators, the matrices. Well, I have F tensor F star. So the that's what a matrix is, actually. A matrix is a linear functional on a vector space with coefficients back in the vector space instead of in the scalars. So a matrix is simply an operator from the space to itself, which is what is accomplished by the Wilson loop. Yeah, a given purple garbage represents a matrix element. Yeah. You're right. Actually, you're right. I shouldn't have said that. You'd have to take the complex conjugate of the twist coefficients that I gave on the previous slide to get F star. That's right. You see, let me explain, Matthew. So the point is, the Hilbert space that I'm going to be working in happens to have an additional algebra structure. It happens that the Hilbert space that we're talking about is a space of operators on something else. That's a feature, it's not a bug. It's actually, it will make the analysis of the double Fibonacci theory quite simple in some cases. So it's just a little bit unusual that the Hilbert space of states happens to be the operators on some other guy. I'm just pointing out that feature. Okay. Okay, so actually this is unnecessary. I thought you don't actually have to understand the single Fibonacci theory to understand what follows. I just thought that it was easier to begin this way. In fact, what I wanted to do is I had a little red disclaimer at the bottom. You should not worry that we're talking about the double. It's not going to be harder to understand or eventually harder to make, in my opinion. The double theory in some ways is simpler than the single theory. Okay, so as suggested by the previous picture of Wilson loops, interacting Wilson loops of tau particles, the doubled theory will be some theory of string nets, also echoing Mike Levin's talk from this morning. So this upper picture is an example of something that might be drawn on the surface that would be okay. This is a legal picture and it'll be in our Hilbert space H, okay? Down below, I drew a second picture of something that's not okay. And can anyone tell me why it's not okay? It violates one of Mike's axioms from this morning's talk. That's bad, okay? Okay, it's not allowed to have a univalent vertex. The vertices are supposed to have either valence 2 or valence 3. Depending on your point of view, valence 2 might not look like a vertex at all. But it might in some combinatorial model. So first, I just want to explain just a simple example of how one might build a Hilbert space of nets. I mean, Mike kind of sketched this without going into specifics, showing how loops could be the effective degrees of freedom of a spin system. So I'd like to just be a little more concrete on how we might make a Hilbert space of nets. And to do this, I'll take you to the honeycomb lattice. And since the honeycomb lattice is bipartite, I'll color half of it red and half of it black. Actually, I learned that physicists call this red part a Bravi lattice. Very pleased to have learned that. And the black part as well. So what we'll do is we'll imagine a spin a half degree of freedom on each of the sites of the honeycomb. And what we'll do in our minds is we'll draw a bond every time we see a minus on a red to a neighboring plus sign on a black. So what I've done here is I've just kind of, for a reason which you'll see in a moment, I've made a little gauge transformation. In this previous, do I have a mirror image? There we go. In my previous drawing, the convention was I just drew an edge connecting all plus signs. So if there was a minus sign like out here, I didn't draw the edge connecting. Well, I'm thinking of, I have a spin a half degree of freedom labeled by plus and minus at the sites, and in my mind I'll draw a bond between any two plus signs. But now I want to take you kind of one step beyond that and you kind of do a gauge transformation, and on the red sublattice I just switch minus and plus. So now I make the slightly more complicated rule that I draw a bond connecting a minus on a red to a plus on a black. Okay? Anywhere I see a plus on a black and a neighboring minus on a red, I in my mind draw, darken in that bond. And now I want to know what are the rules that I have to, what do I have to allow and what do I have to prevent in order to get trivalent graphs. And to prevent dead ends, those univalent vertices that we agreed weren't allowed, it turns out that I just have to add 2 3-body projectors into the Hamiltonian. On the black sites, I have to forbid plus, plus, plus. And on the red sites, I have to forbid minus, minus, minus. So I have to assign energies to these configurations, which I do by putting those projectors in the Hamiltonian. So let's just explain why this should be forbidden. If I see plus, 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 then that means the third red vertex, which it would be sitting above here, that might have a minus on it. And if it does, it's the only neighboring minus. So when I draw the bond from red minus to black plus, I'll have a univalent vertex at the black plus, which I don't want in the Hilbert space. And this is the symmetrical term. Well, these are three-body interactions. That's the bad part. But they're not such ugly three-body interactions. They actually take this Klein form where you're projecting away from the extreme spin states. So, you know, one might plausibly imagine this is some kind of quasi-realistic model. But we can go a step further. I know it's better to have a two-body interaction than a three-body interaction. So I'd like to encrypt the information of spins on two adjacent sites into a spin three-half system living on the bonds. These three-halves has 4 levels, so I can accommodate the 4 possibilities, and then figure out what operators I need to enforce the laws. And let's see, here they are. So it turns out the encryption written at the bottom of the screen is going to be the correct one. In the spin 3/2 state, I left out the denominators of a half, so I'm writing the eigenvalues for the spin operators, minus 3, minus 1, 1, and 3. You can fill in the halves if you're physicists. I'll send, kind of doing this kind of your regular way, minus plus, meaning the arrow's labeled, the arrow can be oriented, tail at red and tip at black. So each arrow in the honeycomb, on a bond on the honeycomb with a labeling at its tip and its tail can be assigned to a spin according to this rule. And then it turns out that that 7 configurations must be permitted and 9 must be excluded in the possible 16 pairs of spin values. And the excluded ones are kind of crossed out by these red lines. And the red lines, if you notice, are the solution of the zeros of a quartic. And here the quartic is written down. you know, it's an equation for a circle here and two equations for a line multiplied together. So what this does is it, in a very concrete way, expresses in terms of the spin operator, the Z spin operator, it expresses the necessary constraints required to impose the branching rules for the Fibonacci theory. So it's a two-body quartic interaction on spin 3/2 particles. And where do the particles live? Well, they live on the bonds of the hexagon, the honeycomb lattice, which is the same thing as the sites of the Kagame. So Eduardo told me just this morning, to my great pleasure, that there, in the pyrochlores, there are spin 3/2 particles living on sites which in a partially decoupled plane give rise to the Kagame lattice. So there's some vague physical connection between this Hamiltonian, not the form of it, but just that it has the right lattice and the right degrees of freedom with the pyrochlore. Okay, so that can be thought of as a prelude. That was simply to illustrate that it might be possible to define the Hilbert space that Mike Levin was living in this morning. So from now on, I'm not going to worry about the details of that Hilbert space. I'm just going to believe that we can, in solid state, find Hilbert spaces whose states are string nets, unoriented, unlabeled string nets. And now I'm going to sort of tell you what the axioms are for sort of a base Hamiltonian, which I'll call H0, from the Hilbert space to itself. And these are sort of the minimal conditions necessary to get into a topological phase, to get into the golden phase, the gold doubled Fibonacci phase. So first is this idea that we should have sort of off-diagonal terms which make the nets fluctuate. You don't want them to freeze into a crystal. Sort of a refinement of two, a refinement of this fluctuation idea, is that we really want to impose isotopy. That is, this dotted line is like the boundary of an imaginary disk, and inside we see a net configuration and then this distortion of topologically the same net configuration. And we'd like to argue, we'd like to assert that the wave function and the ground state give the same amplitude to both these configurations. So it's very democratic up to topological deformation. Now, I'm a little more liberal than Mike was this morning. I'll allow a bond fugacity in there. Within certain reason, and we'll see by the end what that is, we can probably tolerate a multiplicative factor that accounts for the length of the diagram. And then the last important axiom is that tadpoles should be assigned zero weight. So tadpoles are slight generalizations of dead ends. They're simply configurations which, on the boundary of some disk, meet at a single point. Now, the reason for assigning these zero weight is probably experience in 1+1 dimensions. If instead of thinking of this as a two-dimensional quantum system, we think of this as a particle trajectory within one dimension, 1+1, what we see as we move up the screen is we see a single excitation coming out of the vacuum, which looks absurd. So what I'll try to argue is sort of for the inevitability of the doubled Fibonacci theory is the ground state manifold of some perturbation of this Hamiltonian. And the key idea, echoing something that Eduardo said this morning, is nature abhors a degeneracy. Nature is going to try to keep our Hilbert spaces as non-degenerate as possible. And of course, in building topological phases, we're going to have to fool it, because the art of a topological phase is to create a very large degeneracy. But we're going to have to sort of set a trap for nature where we make the degeneracy small at the beginning and force it into larger degeneracies later. So I just wanted to say that this catchphrase, nature abhors a degeneracy, should not be thought of as some Aryan skinhead philosophy, but rather eigenvalue repulsion is what you should be thinking. So what do I mean when I say assume lowest possible dimensions? What to avoid lowest possible degeneracies? What I'll do here is direct your attention to what I'll call the disk spaces. So these are simply, I probably should have used a different letter. Here I'm using script H, which was the letter for the original Hilbert space. I should probably, and will, relabel these V, meaning they're not the Hilbert space of all trivalent graphs in the disk with these boundary conditions, but rather the Hilbert space of lowest energy states. So this is the ground state manifold in a disk with empty boundary conditions, one boundary point, two, three, and four. And I'm just going to assume that their dimensions are these very small numbers, 1, 0, 1, 1. So 0 we already met, that's the tadpole rule, okay? It says that the wave function of the ground state will have zero amplitude on any configuration that where the trivalent graph has a tadpole in it. Okay, so that gets no amplitude. So that space is zero-dimensional. Saying that the first space is one-dimensional is essentially tantamount to saying there's a rule for removing a circle. That is, if I take if the configuration, the graph is a single circle, and I compare that to the configuration which is empty, then they should differ by some scalar, and by definition I'm calling that scalar A. They're two vectors in a one-dimensional space. Similarly, by assuming that this space is one-dimensional, the two-point space, generically I should expect there should be a scalar which relates the presence of a bubble to the absence of a bubble. And similarly, for three lines coming in, the Mercedes symbol times some constant should be the circular Mercedes. Now, the punchline of this slide is that by having done this strange thing of making this 0 instead of 1, we force this number to be big. We force this to be 2 instead of 1. 2 turns out to be the smallest dimension here consistent with the tadpole rule. And this, too, is just the beginning of an exponential explosion. The dimension of these spaces grows exponentially in the golden ratio as we move upwards. So let's try to compute what the relations are in the four-point space and see why the no-tadpole axiom forces us into greater degeneracy later. So to compute the relations in the four-point space, consider the following four diagrams at the top of this slide. These are four different vectors in the Hilbert space consisting of diagrams in the disk with four fixed boundary points as boundary condition. Well, if these are independent, then the Hilbert space with four boundary points is a large space. It's already four-dimensional. So let's assume they're not independent and see how related they might be. And let's just write down an arbitrary relation, capital R. So here I've just written the coefficients among those diagrams. And if that relation holds, then further relations are implied by it by these silly little capping operations where we can join the top two endpoints by an arc, for example, or join it by a party hat down here. Well, let's just in detail look what happens. So what I'm saying is a relation R in the four-point space implies a relation in the two-point space. And let's just see what it is. Well, we should cap each diagram here, and I've done that. This is a bubble which can be removed with a scalar B. So we have H times B times something without a bubble, an arc going through. This is 0 because it has a tadpole. This is just X times straight through, and this is Y times the value of a circle. That's AY. And straight through. So we have a linear relation among this sort of this arc straight through vector. And since it's the same vector in each case, we just get an equation on the coefficients of the relation. And now I haven't written it out in detail, but I just did the same thing for the next three cases. And I get these four linear equations. And you can see something remarkable right away, which is that X and Y fall out. We can use the last two to express them as linear combinations of the other coefficients. And we find right away that there are at most two independent relations. X and Y are not independent parameters. There are at most two independent relations that can be imposed. So that tells us already that our space, which has these four generators, can only support two relations among them. So the four-point space can't be smaller than 4 minus 2. So that's why killing the tadpoles, it looked like it reduced degeneracy when we did it, but it actually increases degeneracy later on. So if we just continue a little bit with the algebra, we find very quickly the Fibonacci numbers, the golden ratio coming out. So the largest possible relation space, which I argue is the physically most natural, because it means the degeneracy is smallest, the largest possible relation space is obtained simply by setting the coefficients in this linear system equal to 0. So this is the linear system that resulted from our first two cappings once we eliminated the variables x and y. And you see there's a symmetry here between the coefficients. And the way we can get the most relations, so the smallest is degeneracy, is by just setting those coefficients equal to 0. Well, if we do that, we just solve algebraically, and we find that A obeys this relation. And going back to the skein pictures, we substitute in the previous pictures and find the F matrix. And then using unitarity of the F matrix together with this algebraic equation, we figure out that it's tau and not its complex conjugate. So we've sort of uniquely found the theory from dimensional grounds alone. Now, what's remarkable about this is normally to specify a TQFT, you have to go to the Pentagon relations, which is a consistency between the 6J symbols. But in this case, the theory is determined at a much earlier level. It's determined simply from dimensional grounds on the disk spaces. So I just want to reiterate that from the rules that we found, these values we've computed for A, B, and C in solving those equations and the F matrix, now the theory is fully computable. And we can make all computations. We can find its particle structure. And it can be identified graphically as the tensor square of the original Fibonacci theory. So I want to end by discussing the statistical physics. So the Potts model tells us quite a lot about both loops and branched loops in two dimensions. The first connection is through the high temperature expansion, and the second through the low temperature expansion. So I don't have time to remind you of the high temperature expansion, but here it is, and written out finally, the partition function written out in terms of a parameter gamma to the number of edges, and a combinatorial factor, which is the colorings, the number of colorings capital Q to the number of clusters. And it's well known that this edge fugacity should be set equal to the square root of the number of colors in order to be at the self-dual or critical point. And this self-dual point is only critical when the number of colors is 4 or less. The number of colors can be any real number. And the high temperature expansion can also be shed light on a loop fugacity if we consider the surround loops of clusters, which I've drawn in green here. At the self-dual point, we find that the Gibbs weight will be critical as long as the loop weight, which I'm taking to be d squared, is in this range. D to the fourth less than 4, so d less than the square root of 2. So what's more directly relevant to the branched loop case is the low temperature expansion. In the low temperature expansion, the partition function for the Potts model is expanded as a sum over trivalent graphs or string nets, where you temporarily are ignoring the colorings of the countries to which the net separate the space. And the weighting for each net is some length fugacity times a combinatorial factor, which is this chromatic polynomial of the dual graph evaluated Q. And if we recall the criticality point, gamma equals the square root of Q, and the relation between gamma and e to the beta j, we find this relation, that at criticality, the partition function is the chromatic evaluation of the dual graph times this particular bond fugacity. Now, the rules that we solve for allow us to compute what I'll call the quantum evaluation. They allow us to compute for any graph on the sphere a real number. And its square will be thought of as like sort of a corresponding unnormalized probability for that graph to occur as an amplitude in the ground state wave function. Now, this quantum evaluation, which can be done using the A, B, C, and F rules that were derived uniquely from dimension hypotheses, the quantum evaluation can be computed, again, in terms of the chromatic polynomial. It turns out to involve at a value, a real number R, turns out to involve the chromatic evaluation at R squared with this vertex fugacity. Now, this is a nice result on how to compute this topological invariant, which is the value of a trivalent graph. But it's beautiful when combined with a theorem from the late 60s of Putt, the graph theorist, who showed that tau squared is the same as tau plus 1. He showed that the golden rate, the chromatic polynomial at the golden ratio plus 1 when squared was very closely related to the chromatic polynomial at the golden ratio plus 2 for any planar triangulation. Well, it turns out that when you combine this to try to get a formula going from the left to the right, all these complicated vertex fugacities kind of burn themselves up, and you're left with this beautiful formula in the red box that the quantum evaluation, this is with the unitary normalization, squared is 1 over tau plus 2, the chromatic polynomial at tau plus 2. Now, this tells us something because the tau plus 2 is 3.6, roughly, less than 4. So we're at a number of colors which potentially is in the critical family of Potts models. But what you don't see in this formula is a bond fugacity. So this means we're in the high temperature limit. The bond fugacity, if you like, is 1. It's not that square root of Q. So, well, actually, this is, yeah, this is the, this value here is the approximately 0.35 is the bond fugacity for criticality of the Potts model at tau plus 2. So the topological ground state, when converted, you know, into, by plasma analogy, into a Gibbs weight, the topological ground state is sitting at the infinite temperature limit above a critical point of the Potts model. And this is exactly analogous to the toric code sitting as the high temperature limit above the Ising critical point. So to summarize, the conclusion is that given a Hilbert space of string nets, and I tried to give at least some hint how you might microscopically create a Hilbert space of string nets, and a Hamiltonian, which follows basically these axioms. It should generate topology, that's the topological invariance, which is a trick. It should kill tadpoles, but nevertheless allow branching. You have a Hamiltonian which obeys these axioms, and furthermore, just does its best to minimize the degeneracies of these first few spaces that come up the disk with 1, 2, and 3 boundary points. Then the double Fibonacci theory is the inevitable ground state of such a Hamiltonian. The second comment is that if we look at parameter values near the golden values for removing a circle, removing a bubble, and removing a bubble at a trivalent vertex, if we look at Hamiltonians which just satisfy the first two, their isotropy and invariant and kill tadpoles, then we expect that such a Hamiltonian will be in a plasma analogy to statistical system corresponding to this Gibbs weight, which, as I said before, is the high temperature limit above the critical point of the Plotz model. So it seems reasonable to expect that for a class of perturbations on such a Hamiltonian, this minimum degeneracy condition would arise and yield the double Fibonacci theory. Thanks. Oh, yeah, right, so there's something slightly deep there. Sorry. Earlier, later? Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, let me not try to come to the right transparency. So remember at the beginning, I tried to reassure you that the double theory would not be harder? And so there is an isomorphism between the double theory and F star tensor F, but the isomorphism is not very transparent. That is, if you think of the double theory graphically in terms of these trivalent string nets, then, for instance, it's not so easy to figure out what the four particles are in that language. And you know from the isomorphism that the four particles are going to be 1 tensor 1, 1 tensor tau, tau tensor 1, and tau tensor tau. But to figure out what those four particles are as superpositions of string nets on annuli, that's an exercise that we've done, but it's not completely obvious. So if you understand the doubled theory in terms of string nets, you're maybe really not seeing and working with in your hands the doubled structure. You're not actually aware all the time that it is F star tensor F. That's sort of a non-trivial isomorphism. But the good side of that, which I was trying to emphasize at the beginning, is in a way that makes it more natural and easy because it has this other basis, which is not obviously a tensor decomposition. I mean, if the only way that you got a double in your hand was by taking two copies of the chiral theory and using them, you know, with opposite chiralities and using them together, that would be kind of weird and unnatural. The point is there's a fundamental thing, which is the string net, and when you work out its theory, it happens to be F star tensor F, but that's a little bit in the background.
What sort of computation do you do to really nail that down? You're starting with the string net.
Yeah.
All these things, how do you, what sort of computation will tell you
the answer? That it's F star tensor F? I mean, the isomorphism is you have to find the irreducible representations of the string net category. And there are four of them, and you can line them up with the four tensor particles, and then you can line up everything. So I don't know. And then there's a more abstract way of knowing that it's correct. The more abstract way is that the undoubled theory can be described as string nets not living in a torus, say, in the surface, but string nets living in an arbitrary fixed three-manifold of the surface bounds. So you can describe the undoubled theory as string nets living in, say, a handle body. And then you can think of the string net theory as string nets living in a surface cross I. And then you see that the double is sort of forced upon you by the fact that a surface cross I has two boundaries, the inner and the outer boundary with opposite orientation. So there's sort of an abstract topological reason that it's inevitable that the string net theory is the double. But if you don't want that abstract reason, you can also compute everything in terms of little pictures. Yeah. Yeah, you do. Yeah, so let me see if that last formula seems to have. Yeah, so that doesn't look right. Now we're rotating it out. Okay, there we go. What's that group? D4. Okay, so that formula in the box is kind of a beautiful thing, and I should say that Eduardo and Paul Fenley basically had this in their paper, but we're using a different normalization here. So the point is, in writing down this string net theory, remember the space, the disk with three boundary points is a one-dimensional space, and a vector in it is this Mercedes symbol, just three lines coming together. But it makes some difference whether you decide that that's a unit vector or not a unit vector. And it shouldn't actually be chosen to be a unit vector. The correct normalization, its length should be tau to the tau to the half, I think, actually. And anyway, if you normalize the length of that vector correctly, then you get a unitary theory. And if you make one calculation with a different normalization, if you make two calculations with different normalizations, then the difference is some vertex fugacity. But it turns out if you use the unitary normalization for the theory, you know, the normalization that makes the F matrix a unitary matrix, then there's no, when you stick these two together, by a miracle, there's no vertex fugacity or length fugacity left. So it's sort of, you know, like it's a miracle of nature. That's like, by choosing the right normalization here, you get this very beautiful, simple formula. No, no, I'm not. I mean, to go into a topological theory, you definitely need to impose these the F matrix in some form or other. But no, I didn't impose the. Actually, I took a slightly different point of view. You see, imposing the F matrix as opposed to some other relations on strands is sort of making a choice. A more general point of view is just to say that the degeneracy of certain Hilbert spaces is going to be small. Those are the disk spaces. So if you assume the degeneracy of those disk spaces is as small as possible, then that essentially is imposing this some extra relation on string nets, which will bring you automatically to the double Fibonacci theory.
Is there an increasing symmetry associated with the increase in degeneracy? Because often, for instance, you know, degeneracy is associated with some symmetry, you break the symmetry into levels. Is there some increasing symmetry?
Well, I mean, I think you could say that if you move through a family of TQFTs, if you went to higher and higher levels, you could probably justly call those increasingly symmetric. But here, we have one TQFT, and it has one symmetry algebra, and we're just realizing the TQFT on, say, surfaces of higher and higher genus, or surfaces with more and more punctures, and their dimension is going up, but I think the symmetry that's acting behind the scenes is constant. Thanks a lot.